where I will live out the remainder of my days. I agreed to reproduce at least twice to give my corrective genes the best possible chance of survival. I understand that I will be encouraged to do this when I am re-educated after the reset procedure. I also give my consent for my children and my children's children, etc., to continue in this experiment until such time as the Bureau of Genetic Welfare deems it to be complete. They will be instructed in the false history that I myself will be given after the reset procedure. Signed, Amanda Marie Ritter. Amanda Marie Ritter. She was the woman in the video. Edith Pryor. My ancestor. I look up at Caleb, whose eyes are alight with knowledge, like there's a live wire running through each of them. Our ancestor. I pull out one of the chairs and sit. She was Dad's ancestor? He nods and sits down across from me. 7 generations back. Yes, an aunt. Her brother is the one who carried on the prior name. And this is... It's a consent form, he says. Her consent form for joining the experiment. The endnotes say that this was just a first draft. She was one of the original experiment designers, a member of the Bureau. There were only a few Bureau members in the original experiment. Most of the people in the experiment weren't working for the government. I read the words again, trying to make sense of them. When I saw her in the video, it seemed so logical that she would become a resident of our city, that she would immerse herself in our factions, that she would volunteer to leave behind everything she left behind. But that was before I knew what life was like outside the city, and it doesn't seem as horrific as what Edith described in her message to us. She delivered a skillful manipulation in that video, which was intended to keep us contained and dedicated to the vision of the Bureau. The world outside the city is badly broken, and the Divergent need to come out here and heal it. It's not quite a lie, because the people in the Bureau do believe that healed genes will fix certain things, that if we integrate into the general population and pass our genes on, the world will be a better place. But they didn't need the Divergent to march out of our city like an army to fight injustice and save everyone, as Edith suggested. I wonder if Edith Pryor believed her own words, or if she just said them because she had to. There's a photograph of her on the next page, her mouth in a firm line, wisps of brown hair hanging around her face. She must have seen something terrible, to volunteer for her memory to be erased and her entire life remade. Do you know why she joined? I say. Caleb shakes his head. The records suggest, though they're fairly vague on this front, that people joined the experiment so their families could escape extreme poverty. The families of the subjects were offered a monthly stipend for the subjects' participation, for upward of 10 years. But obviously that wasn't Edith's motivation, since she worked for the Bureau. I suspect something traumatic must have happened to her, something she was determined to forget. I frown at her photograph. I can't imagine what kind of poverty would motivate a person to forget themselves and everyone they loved so their families could get a monthly stipend. I may have lived on abnegation bread and vegetables for most of my life, with nothing to spare, but I was never that desperate. Their situation must have been much worse than anything I saw in the city. I can't imagine why Edith was that desperate either. Or maybe it's just that she didn't have anyone to keep her memory for. I was interested in the legal precedent for giving consent on behalf of one's descendants, Caleb says. I think it's an extrapolation of giving consent for one's children under 18, but it seems a little odd. I guess we all decide our children's fates just by making our own life decisions, I say vaguely. Would we have chosen the same factions we did if Mom and Dad hadn't chosen abnegation? I shrug. I don't know. Maybe we wouldn't have felt as stifled. Maybe we would have become different people, The thought creeps into my mind like a slithering creature. Maybe we would have become better people. People who don't betray their own sisters. I stare at the table in front of me. For the past few minutes, it was easy to pretend that Caleb and I were just brother and sister again. But a person can only keep reality and anger at bay for so long before the truth comes back again. As I raise my eyes to his, I think of looking at him in just this way. When I was still a prisoner in Erudite headquarters, I think of being too tired to fight with him anymore, or to hear his excuses, too tired to care that my brother had abandoned me. I ask tersely, "Edith joined Erudite, didn't she? Even though she took an abnegation name?" "Yes." He doesn't seem to notice my tone. In fact, most of our ancestors were an Erudite. There were a few abnegation outliers, and one or two Kandor. But the through line is fairly consistent. I feel cold, like I might shiver and then shatter. "So I suppose you've used this as an excuse in your twisted mind for what you did," I say steadily. "For joining Erudite, for being loyal to them. I mean, if you were supposed to be one of them all along, then faction before blood is an acceptable thing to believe, right?"
"Triss,"
he says, and his eyes plead with me for understanding. But I do not understand. I won't. I stand up. "So, now I know about Edith and you know about our mother. Good. Let's just leave it at that then." Sometimes, when I look at him, I feel the ache of sympathy toward him. And sometimes, I feel like I want to wrap my hands around his throat. But right now, I just want to escape and pretend this never happened. I walk out of the records room, and my shoes squeak on the tile floor as I run back to the hotel. I run until I smell sweet citrus, and then I stop. Tobias is standing in the hallway outside the dormitory. I am breathless, and I can feel my heartbeat even in my fingertips. I am overwhelmed, teeming with loss and wonder and anger and longing. "Triss," Tobias says, his brow furrowed with concern. "Are you all right?" I shake my head, still struggling for air, and crush him against the wall with my body, my lips finding his. For a moment he tries to push me away, but then he must decide that he doesn't care if I'm all right. Doesn't care if he's all right. Doesn't care. We haven't been alone together in days, weeks, months. His fingers slide into my hair, and I hold on to his arms to stay steady as we press together like two blades at a stalemate. He is stronger than anyone I know, and warmer than anyone else realizes. He is a secret that I have kept, and will keep, for the rest of my life. He leans down and kisses my throat, hard, and his hands smooth over me, securing themselves at my waist. I hook my fingers in his belt loops, my eyes closing. In that moment, I know exactly what I want. I want to peel away all the layers of clothing between us, strip away everything that separates us, the past and the present and the future. I hear footsteps and laughter at the end of the hallway, and we break apart. Someone, probably Uriah, whistles, but I barely hear it over the pulsing in my ears. Tobias's eyes meet mine, and it's like the first time I really looked at him during my initiation, after my fear simulation. We stare too long, too intently. "Shut up," I call out to Uriah, without looking away. Uriah and Christina walk into the dormitory, and Tobias and I follow them, like nothing happened.
Chapter 23. Tobias. That night, when my head hits the pillow, heavy with thoughts, I hear something crinkle beneath my cheek, a note under my pillowcase. "T, meet me outside the hotel entrance at 11. I need to talk to you. Nita." I look at Triss's cot. She sprawled on her back, and there is a piece of hair covering her nose and mouth that shifts with each exhale. I don't want to wake her, but I feel strange going to meet a girl in the middle of the night without telling her about it. Especially now that we're trying so hard to be honest with each other. I check my watch. It's 10 to 11. Nita's just a friend. You can tell Triss tomorrow. It might be urgent. I push the blankets back and shove my feet into my shoes. I sleep in my clothes these days. I pass Peter's cot, then Uriah's. The top of a flask peeks out from beneath Uriah's pillow. I pinch it between my fingers and carry it toward the door, where I slide it under the pillow on one of the empty cots. I haven't been looking after him as well as I promised Zeke I would. Once I'm in the hallway, I tie my shoes and smooth my hair down. I stopped cutting it like the abnegation when I wanted the Dauntless to see me as a potential leader, but I miss the ritual of the old way, the buzz of the clippers and the careful movements of my hands, knowing more by touch than by sight. When I was young, my father used to do it, in the hallway on the top floor of our abnegation house. He was always too careless with the blade, and scraped the back of my neck or nicked my ear. But he never complained about having to cut my hair for me. That's something, I guess. Nita is tapping her foot. This time she wears a white short-sleeved shirt, her hair pulled back. She smiles, but it doesn't quite reach her eyes. "You look worried," I say.
"That's because I am," she answers.
"Come on, there's a place I've been wanting to show you." She leads me down dim hallways, empty except for the occasional janitor. They all seem to know Nita. They wave at her or smile. She puts her hands in her pockets, guiding her eyes carefully away from mine every time we happen to look at each other. We go through a door without a security sensor to keep it locked. The room beyond it is a wide circle with a chandelier marking its center with dangling glass. The floors are polished wood, dark, and the walls, covered in sheets of bronze, gleam where the light touches them. There are names inscribed on bronze panels, dozens of names. Nita stands beneath the glass chandelier and holds her arms out wide to encompass the room in her gesture.
"These are the Chicago family trees," she says. "Your family trees."
I move closer to one of the walls and read through the names, searching for one that looks familiar. At the end, I find one. Uriah Pedred and Ezekiel Pedred. Next to each name is a small DD, and there is a dot next to Uriah's name, and it looks freshly carved, marking him as divergent, probably.
"Do you know where mine is?" I say.
She crosses the room and touches one of the panels. "The generations are matrilineal. That's why Janine's record said Triss was second generation, because her mother came from outside the city. I'm not sure how Janine knew that, but I guess we'll never find out." I approach the panel that bears my name with trepidation, though I'm not sure what I have to fear from seeing my name and my parents' names carved into bronze. I see a vertical line connecting Kristen Johnson to Evelyn Johnson, and a horizontal one connecting Evelyn Johnson to Marcus Eaton. Below the two names is just one, Tobias Eaton. The small letters beside my name are A.D., and there's a dot there, too, though I know I'm not actually divergent.
"The first letter is your faction of origin," she says, "and the second is your faction of choice. They thought that keeping track of the factions would help them trace the path of the genes."
My mother's letters. E-A-F. The F is for factionless, I assume. My father's letters. A-A, with a dot. I touch the line connecting me to them, and the line connecting Evelyn to her parents, and the line connecting them to their parents all the way back through 8 generations, counting my own. This is a map of what I've always known, that I am tied to them, bound forever to this empty inheritance no matter how far I run. "While I appreciate you showing me this," I say, and I feel sad and tired. I'm not sure why it had to happen in the middle of the night.
"I thought you might want to see it. And I had something I wanted to talk to you about."
"More reassurance that my limitations don't define me?" I shake my head. "No, thanks. I've had enough of that."
"No," she says, "but I'm glad you said that."
She leans against the panel, covering Evelyn's name with her shoulder. I step back, not wanting to be so close to her that I can see the ring of lighter brown around her pupils.
That conversation I had with you last night, about genetic damage, it was actually a test. I wanted to see how you would react to what I said about damaged genes so I would know whether I could trust you or not, she says. If you accepted what I said about your limitations, the answer would have been no. She slides a little closer to me so her shoulder covers Marcus's name, too. See, I'm not really on board with being classified as damaged. I think of the way she spat out the explanation of the tattoo of broken glass on her back like it was poison. My heart starts to beat harder so I can feel the pulse in my throat. Bitterness has replaced the good humor in her voice, and her eyes have lost their warmth. I am afraid of her. Afraid of what she says, and thrilled by it, too, because it means I don't have to accept that I am smaller than I once believed. I take it you aren't on board with it either, she says. No, I'm not. There are a lot of secrets in this place, she says. One of them is that to them, a GD is expendable. Another is that some of us are not just going to sit back and take it. What do you mean expendable? I say. The crimes they have committed against people like us are serious, Nita says, and hidden. I can show you evidence, but that will have to come later. For now, what I can tell you is that we're working against the Bureau, for good reasons, and we want you with us. I narrow my eyes. Why? What is it you want from me, exactly? Right now, I want to offer you an opportunity to see what the world is like outside the compound. And what you get in return is... Your protection, she says. I'm going to a dangerous place, and I can't tell anyone else from the Bureau about it. You're an outsider, which means it's safe for me to trust you, and I know you know how to defend yourself. And if you come with me, I'll show you that evidence you want to see. She touches her heart, lightly, as if swearing on it. My skepticism is strong, but my curiosity is stronger. It's not hard for me to believe that the Bureau would do bad things, because every government I've ever known has done bad things, even the abnegation oligarchy of which my father was the head. And even beyond that reasonable suspicion, I have brewing inside me the desperate hope that I am not damaged, that I am worth more than the corrected genes I pass on to any children I might have. So I decide to go along with this. For now. Fine, I say. First, she says, before I show you anything, you have to accept that you won't be able to tell anyone, even Triss, about what you see. Are you all right with that? She's trustworthy, you know. I promised Triss I wouldn't keep any secrets from her anymore. I shouldn't get into situations where I'll have to do it again. Why can't I tell her? I'm not saying she isn't trustworthy. It's just that she doesn't have the skill set we need, and we don't want to put anyone at risk that we don't have to. See, the Bureau doesn't want us to organize. If we believe we're not damaged, then we're saying that everything they're doing, the experiments, the genetic alterations, all of it, is a waste of time. And no one wants to hear that their life's work is a sham. I know all about that. It's like finding out that the factions are an artificial system designed by scientists to keep us under control for as long as possible. She pulls away from the wall. And then she says the only thing she could possibly say to make me agree. If you tell her, you would be depriving her of the choice I'm giving you now. You would force her to become a co-conspirator. By keeping this from her, you would be protecting her. I run my fingers over my name, carved into the metal panel. Tobias Eaton. These are my genes. This is my mess. I don't want to pull Triss into it. All right, I say. Show me. I watch her flashlight beam bob up and down with her footsteps. We just retrieved a bag from a mop closet down the hall. She was ready for this. She leads me deep into the underground hallways of the compound, past the place where the GDs gather, to a corridor where the electricity no longer flows. At a certain place, she crouches and slides her hand along the ground until her fingers reach a latch. She hands me the flashlight and pulls back the latch, lifting a door from the tile. It's an escape tunnel, she says. They dug it when they first came here, so there would always be a way to escape during an emergency. From her bag, she takes a black tube and twists off the top. It sprays sparks of light that glow red against her skin. She releases it over the doorway and it falls several feet, leaving a streak of light on my eyelids. She sits on the edge of the hole, her backpack secure around her shoulders, and drops. I know it's just a short way down, but it feels like more with the space open beneath me. I sit, the silhouette of my shoes dark against the red sparks, and push myself forward. Interesting, Nita says when I land. I lift up the flashlight, and she holds the flare out in front of her as we walk down the tunnel, which is just wide enough for the two of us to walk side by side, and just tall enough for me to straighten up. It smells rich and rotten, like mold and dead air. I forgot you were afraid of heights. Well, I'm not afraid of much else, I say. No need to get defensive, she smiles. I actually have always wanted to ask you about that. I step over a puddle, the soles of my shoes gripping the gritty tunnel floor. Your third fear, she says, shooting that woman. Who was she? The flare goes out, so the flashlight I'm holding is our only guide through the tunnel. I shift my arm to create more space between us, not wanting to skim her arm in the dark. She wasn't anyone in particular, I say. The fear was shooting her. You were afraid of shooting people? No, I say. I was afraid of my considerable capacity to kill. She is silent, and so am I. That's the first time I've ever said those words out loud, and now I hear how strange they are. How many young men fear that there is a monster inside them? People are supposed to fear others, not themselves. People are supposed to aspire to become their fathers, not shudder at the thought. I've always wondered what would be in my fear landscape. She says it in hushed tone, like a prayer. Sometimes I feel like there is so much to be afraid of, and sometimes I feel like there is nothing left to fear. I nod, though she can't see me, and we keep moving, the flashlight beam bouncing, our shoes scraping, the moldy air rushing toward us from whatever is on the other end. After 20 minutes of walking, we turn a corner, and I smell fresh wind, cold enough to make me shudder. I turn off the flashlight, and the moonlight at the end of the tunnel guides us to our exit. The tunnel led us out somewhere in the wasteland we drove through to get to the compound, among the crumbling buildings and overgrown trees breaking through the pavement. Parked a few feet away is an old truck, the back covered in shredded threadbare canvas. Nita kicks one of the tires to test it, then climbs into the driver's seat. The keys already dangle from the ignition. Whose truck? I say when I get into the passenger seat. It belongs to the people we're going to meet. I asked them to park it here, she says. And who are they? Friends of mine. I don't know how she finds her way through the maze of streets before us, but she does, steering the truck around tree roots and fallen streetlights, flashing the headlights at animals that scamper at the edge of my vision. A long-legged creature with a brown, spare body picks its way across the street ahead of us, almost as tall as the headlights. Nita eases on the brakes so she doesn't hit it. Its ears twitch, and its dark, round eyes watch us with careful curiosity like a child. Sort of beautiful, aren't they? She says. Before I came here, I'd never seen a deer. I nod. It is elegant, but hesitant, halting. Nita presses the horn with her fingertips and the deer moves out of the way. We accelerate again, then reach a wide, open road suspended across the railroad tracks I once walked down to reach the compound. I see its lights up ahead, the one bright spot in this dark wasteland. And we are traveling northeast, away from it. It is a long time before I see electric light again. When I do, it is along a narrow, patchy street. The bulbs dangle from a cord strung across the old streetlights. We stop here. Nita jerks the wheel, pulling the truck into an alley between two brick buildings. She takes the keys from the ignition and looks at me. Check in the glove box. I asked them to give us weapons. I open the compartment in front of me. Sitting on top of some old wrappers are two knives. How are you with a knife? She says.
The Dauntless taught initiates how to throw knives even before the changes to initiation that Max made before I joined them. I never liked it, because it seemed like a way to encourage the Dauntless flair for theatrics rather than a useful skill. I'm all right, I say with a smirk. I never thought that skill would actually be worth anything, though.
I guess the Dauntless are good for something after all.
For, she says, smiling a little. She takes the larger of the two knives and I take the smaller one. I am tense, turning the handle in my fingers as we walk down the alley. Above me, the windows flicker with a different kind of light. Flames from candles or lanterns. At one point when I glance up, I see a curtain of hair and dark eye sockets staring back at me.
People live here, I say.
This is the very edge of the fringe, Nita says. It's about a 2-hour drive from Milwaukee, which is a metropolitan area north of here.
Yeah, people live here.
These days people don't venture too far away from cities, even if they want to live outside the government's influence, like the people here.
Why do they want to live outside the government's influence?
I know what living outside the government is like by watching the factionless. They were always hungry, always cold in the winter and hot in the summer, always struggling to survive. It's not an easy life to choose. You have to have a good reason for it.
Because they're genetically damaged, Nita says, glancing at me. Genetically damaged people are technically, legally equal to genetically pure people, but only on paper, so to speak. In reality, they're poorer, more likely to be convicted of crimes, less likely to be hired for good jobs, you name it. It's a problem, and has been since the Purity War over a century ago. For the people who live in the fringe, it seemed more appealing to opt out of society completely rather than to try to correct the problem from within, like I intend to do. I think of the fragment of glass tattooed on her skin. I wonder when she got it. I wonder what put that dangerous look in her eyes, what put such drama in her speech, what made her become a revolutionary. How do you plan on doing that? She sets her jaw and says, by taking away some of the Bureau's power. The alley opens up to a wide street. Some people prowl along the edges, but others walk right in the middle in lurching groups, bottles swinging from their hands. Everyone I see is young. Not many adults in the fringe, I guess. I hear shouting up ahead and glass shattering on the pavement. A crowd there stands in a circle around two punching, kicking figures. I start toward them, but Nita grabs my arm and drags me toward one of the buildings. Not the time to be a hero, she says. We approach the door to the building on the corner. A large man stands beside it, spinning a knife in his palm. When we walk up the steps, he stops the knife and tosses it into his other hand, which is gnarled with scars. His size, his deftness with the weapon, his scarred and dusty appearance, they are all supposed to intimidate me. But his eyes are like that deer's eyes, large and wary and curious.
We're here to see Raffi, she says. We're from the compound.
You can go in, but your knives stay here, the man says.
His voice is higher, lighter than I expected. He could be a gentleman, maybe, if this were a different kind of place. As it is, I see that he isn't gentle. Doesn't even know what that means. Even though I myself have discarded any kind of softness as useless, I find myself thinking that something important is lost if this man has been forced to deny his own nature.
Not a chance, Nita says.
Nita? Is that you?
Says a voice from inside. It is expressive, musical. The man to whom it belongs is short with a wide smile. He comes to the doorway.
Didn't I tell you to just let them in? Come in, come in.
Hi, Raffi, she says, her relief obvious. Four, this is Raffi. He's an important man in the fringe.
Nice to meet you,
Raffi says, as he beckons for us to follow him. Inside is a large, open room lit by rows of candles and lanterns. There is wooden furniture strewn everywhere, all the tables empty but one. A woman sits in the back of the room, and Raffi slides into the chair beside her. Though they don't look the same, she has red hair and a generous frame. His features are dark and his body spare as a wire. They have the same sort of look. like two stones hewn by the same chisel.
"Weapons on the table," Raffi says.
This time Nita obeys, putting her knife on the edge of the table right in front of her. She sits. I do the same. Across from us, the woman surrenders a gun.
"Who's this?"
the woman says, jerking her head toward me.
"This is my associate," Nita says. "Four."
"What kind of a name is Four?"
She doesn't ask with a sneer, the way people have often asked me that question. "The kind you get inside the city experiment," Nita says, "for having only four fears." It occurs to me that she might have introduced me by that name just to have the opportunity to share where I'm from. Does it give her some kind of leverage? Does it make me more trustworthy to these people?
"Interesting."
The woman taps the table with her index finger.
"Well, Four, my name is Mary."
"Mary and Raffi lead the Midwest branch of a GD rebel group," Nita says.
"Calling it a group makes us sound like old ladies playing cards," Raffi says smoothly. "We're more of an uprising. Our reach stretches across the country. There's a group for every metropolitan area that exists, and regional overseers for the Midwest, South, and East."
"Is there a West?" I say.
"Not anymore," Nita says quietly. "The terrain was too difficult to navigate, and the city's too spread out for it to be sensible to live there after the war. Now it's wild country."
"So it's true what they say,"
Mary says, her eyes catching the light like slivers of glass as she looks at me.
"The people in the city experiments really don't know what's outside."
"Of course it's true. Why would they?" Nita says. Fatigue, a weight behind my eyes, creeps up on me suddenly. I've been a part of too many uprisings in my short life. The factionless, and now this GD one, apparently.
"Not to cut the pleasantries short," Mary says, "but we shouldn't spend much time here. We can't keep people out for long before they come sniffing around."
"Right," Nita says. She looks at me.
"Four, can you make sure nothing's happening outside? I need to talk to Mary and Raffi privately for a little while."
If we were alone, I would ask why I can't be here when she talks to them, or why she bothered to bring me in when I could have stood guard outside the whole time. I guess I haven't actually agreed to help her yet, and she must have wanted them to meet me for some reason. So I just get up, taking my knife with me, and walk to the door where Raffi's guard watches the street. The fight across the street has died down. A lone figure lies on the pavement. For a moment I think it's still moving, but then I realize that's because someone is rifling through its pockets. It's not a figure. It's a body.
"Dead?"
I say, and the word is just an exhale.
"Yep. If you can't defend yourself here, you won't last the night."
"Why do people come here then?" I frown. "Why don't they just go back to the cities?" He's quiet for so long that I think he must not have heard my question. I watch the thief turn the dead person's pockets inside out and abandon the body, slipping into one of the nearby buildings. Finally, Raffi's guard speaks.
"Here there's a chance that if you die, someone will care. Like Raffi or one of the other leaders," the guard says. "In the cities, if you get killed, definitely no one will give a damn. Not if you're a GD. The worst crime I've ever seen a GP get charged with for killing a GD was manslaughter. Bullshit."
"Manslaughter?"
"It means the crime is deemed an accident," Raffi's smooth, lilting voice says behind me. "Or at least not as severe as, say, first-degree murder. Officially, of course, we're all treated the same, yes? But that is rarely put into practice."
He stands beside me, his arms folded. I see when I look at him a king surveying his own kingdom, which he believes is beautiful. I look out at the street, at the broken pavement and the limp body with its turned-out pockets, and the windows flickering with firelight, and I know the beauty he sees is just freedom. Freedom to be seen as a whole man instead of a damaged one. I saw that freedom once, when Evelyn beckoned to me from among the factionless, called me out of my faction to become a more complete person,
but it was a lie.
You're from Chicago?
Rafi says to me. I nod, still looking at the dark street.
And now that you are out,
how does the world seem to you? He says. Mostly the same, I say. People are just divided by different things, fighting different wars. Nita's footsteps creak on the floorboards inside, and when I turn, she is standing right behind me, her hands buried in her pockets.
Thanks for arranging this, Nita says, nodding to Rafi. It's time for us to go.
We make our way down the street again, and when I turn to look at Rafi, he has his hand up, waving goodbye. As we walk back to the truck, I hear screams again, but this time they are the screams of a child. I walk past snuffling, whimpering sounds and think of when I was younger, crouching in my bedroom, wiping my nose on one of my sleeves. My mother used to scrub the cuffs with a sponge before throwing them in the wash. She never said anything about it. When I get into the truck, I already feel numb to this place and its pain, and I am ready to get back to the dream of the compound, the warmth and the light and the feeling of safety. I'm having trouble understanding why this place is preferable to city life, I say.
I've only been to a city that wasn't an experiment once, Nita says. There's electricity, but it's on a ration system. Each family only gets so many hours a day. Same with water. And there's a lot of crime, which is blamed on genetic damage. There are police, too, but they can only do so much.
So the Bureau compound, I say. It's easily the best place to live, then.
In terms of resources, yes, Nita says. But the same social system that exists in the cities also exists in the compound. It's just a little harder to see.
I watch the fringe disappear in the rearview mirror, distinct from the abandoned buildings around it only by the string of electric lights draped over the narrow street. We drive past dark houses with boarded-up windows, and I try to imagine them clean and polished as they must have been at some point in the past. They have fenced-in yards that must have once been trim and green, windows that must once have glowed in the evenings. I imagine that the lives lived here were peaceful ones, quiet ones.
What did you come out here to talk to them about, exactly?
I say.
I came out here to solidify our plans, Nita says.
I notice in the glow of the dashboard light that there are a few cuts on her lower lip, like she has spent too much time biting it.
And I wanted them to meet you, to put a face on the people inside the faction experiments. Mary used to be suspicious that people like you were actually colluding with the government, which of course isn't true. Rafi, though, he was the first person to give me proof that the Bureau, the government, was lying to us about our history.
She pauses after she says it, like that will help me to feel the weight of it. But I don't need time or silence or space to believe her. I have been lied to by my government for my entire life.
The Bureau talks about this golden age of humanity before the genetic manipulations in which everyone was genetically pure and everything was peaceful, Nita says. But Rafi showed me old photographs of war.
I wait a beat. So?
So, Nita demands, incredulous, if genetically pure people caused war and total devastation in the past at the same magnitude that genetically damaged people supposedly do now, then what's the basis for thinking that we need to spend so many resources and so much time working to correct genetic damage? What's the use of the experiments at all, except to convince the right people that the government is doing something to make all our lives better, even though it's not?
The truth changes everything. Isn't that why Triss was so desperate to get the Edith Pryor video shown that she allied herself with my father to do it? She knew that the truth, whatever it was, would change our struggle, would shift our priorities forever. And here, now, a lie has changed the struggle. A lie has shifted priorities forever. Instead of working against the poverty or crime that have run rampant over this country, these people have chosen to work against genetic damage. Why? Why spend so much time and energy fighting something that isn't really a problem? I demand, suddenly frustrated.
Well, the people fighting it now probably fight it because they have been taught that it is a problem. That's another thing that Rafi showed me, examples of the propaganda the government released about genetic damage, Nita says. But initially, I don't know.
It's probably a dozen things. Prejudice against GDs? Control, maybe? Control the genetically damaged population by teaching them that there's something wrong with them, and control the genetically pure population by teaching them that they're healed and whole. These things don't happen overnight, and they don't happen for just one reason.
I lean the side of my head against the cold window and close my eyes. There is too much information buzzing in my brain to focus on any single part of it, so I give up trying and let myself drift off. By the time we make it back through the tunnel and I find my bed, the sun is about to rise, and Triss's arm is hanging over the edge of her bed again, her fingertips brushing the floor. I sit down across from her, for a moment watching her sleeping face and thinking of what we agreed that night in Millennium Park. No more lies. She promised me, and I promised her. And if I don't tell her about what I heard and saw tonight, I will be going back on that promise. And for what? To protect her? For Nita, a girl I barely know? I brush her hair away from her face, gently so I don't wake her. She doesn't need my protection. She's strong enough on her own.
Chapter 24. Triss. Peter is across the room, gathering a stack of books into a pile and shoving them into a bag. He bites down on a red pen and carries the bag out of the room. I hear the books inside it smacking against his leg as he walks down the hallway. I wait until I can't hear them anymore before I turn to Christina. I've been trying not to ask you, but I'm giving up, I say. What's going on with you and Uriah? Christina, sprawled across her cot with one long leg dangling over the edge, gives me a look. What? You've been spending a lot of time together, I say. Like, a lot. It's sunny today, the light glowing through the white curtains. I don't know how, but the dormitory smells like sleep, like laundry and shoes and night sweats and morning coffee. Some of the beds are made, and some still have rumpled sheets bunched up at the bottom or the side. Most of us came from Dauntless, but I'm struck by how different we are anyway. Different habits, different temperaments, different ways of seeing the world. You may not believe me, but it's not like that. Christina props herself up on her elbows. He's grieving. We're both bored. Also, he's Uriah. So? He's good-looking. Good-looking, but he can't have a serious conversation to save his life. Christina shakes her head. Don't get me wrong. I like to laugh. But I also want a relationship to mean something, you know? I nod. I do know. Better than most people. Maybe because Tobias and I aren't really the joking type. Besides, she says, not every friendship turns into a romance. I haven't tried to kiss you yet. I laugh. True. Where have you been lately? Christina says. She wiggles her eyebrows. With four? Doing a little addition, multiplication. I cover my face with my hands. That was the worst joke I've ever heard. Don't dodge the question. No addition for us, I say. Not yet, anyway. He's been a little preoccupied with the whole genetic damage thing. Ah, that thing. She sits up. What do you think about it? I say. I don't know. I guess it makes me angry. She frowns. No one likes to be told there's something wrong with them, especially something like their genes, which they can't change. You think there's really something wrong with you? I guess so. It's like a disease, right? They can see it in our genes. That's not really up for debate, is it? I'm not saying your genes aren't different, I say. I'm just saying that doesn't mean one set is damaged and one set isn't. The genes for blue eyes and brown eyes are different, too. But are blue eyes damaged? It's like they just arbitrarily decided that one kind of DNA was bad and the other was good. Based on the evidence that GD behavior was worse, Christina points out. Which could be caused by a lot of things, I retort. I don't know why I'm arguing with you when I'd really like for you to be right, Christina says, laughing. But don't you think a bunch of smart people like these bureau scientists could figure out the cause of bad behavior? Sure, I say. But I think that no matter how smart, people usually see what they're already looking for. That's all. Maybe you're biased, too, she says. Because you have friends and a boyfriend with this genetic issue. Maybe. I know I'm fumbling for an explanation. One I may not really believe, but I say it anyway. I guess I don't see a reason to believe in genetic damage. Will it make me treat other people better? No, the opposite, maybe. And besides, I see what it's doing to Tobias, how it's making him doubt himself, and I don't understand how anything good can possibly come from it. You don't believe things because they make your life better. You believe them because they're true, she points out. But, I speak slowly as I mull that over. Isn't looking at the result of a belief a good way of evaluating if it's true? Sounds like a stiff way of thinking. She pauses. I guess my way is very candor, though. God, we really can't escape factions no matter where we go, can we? I shrug. Maybe it's not so important to escape them. Tobias walks into the dormitory, looking pale and exhausted, like he always does these days. His hair is pushed up on one side from lying on his pillow, and he's still wearing what he wore yesterday. He's been sleeping in his clothes since we came to the bureau. Christina gets up. Okay, I'm going to go, and leave you to all this space. Alone. She gestures at all the empty beds, and then winks conspicuously at me as she walks out of the dormitory. Tobias smiles a little, but not enough to make me think he's actually happy. And instead of sitting next to me, he lingers at the foot of my bed, his fingers fumbling over the hem of his shirt. There's something I want to talk to you about, he says. Okay, I say, and I feel a spike of fear in my chest. Like a jump on a heart monitor. I want to ask you to promise not to get mad, he says. But you know I don't make stupid promises, I say, my throat tight. Right. He does sit then, in the curve of blankets left unmade on his bed. He avoids my eyes. Nita left a note under my pillow, telling me to meet her last night. And I did. I straighten. I can feel an angry heat spreading through me as I picture Nita's pretty face, Nita's graceful feet, walking toward my boyfriend. A pretty girl asks you to meet her late at night, and you go? I demand. And then you want me not to get mad about it? It's not about that with Nita and me, at all, he says hastily, finally looking at me. She just wanted to show me something. She doesn't believe in genetic damage, like she led me to believe. She has a plan to take away some of the Bureau's power, to make GDs more equal. We went to the fringe. He tells me about the underground tunnel that leads outside, and the ramshackle town in the fringe, and the conversation with Raffi and Mary. He explains the war that the government kept hidden so that no one would know that genetically pure people are capable of incredible violence, and the way GDs live in the metropolitan areas where the government still has real power. As he speaks, I feel suspicion toward Nita building inside me, but I don't know where it comes from. The gut instinct I usually trust, or my jealousy. When he finishes, he looks at me expectantly, and I purse my lips, trying to decide. How do you know she's telling you the truth? I say. I don't, he says. She promised to show me evidence. Tonight. He takes my hand. I'd like you to come. And Nita will be okay with that? I don't really care. His fingers slide between mine. If she really needs my help, she'll have to figure out how to be okay with it. I look at our joined fingers, at the fraying cuff of his gray shirt and the worn knee of his jeans. I don't want to spend time with Nita and Tobias together, knowing that her supposed genetic damage gives her something in common with him that I will never have. But this is important to him, and I want to know if there's evidence of the Bureau's wrongdoing as much as he does. Okay, I say. I'll go. But don't for a second think that I actually believe she's not interested in you for more than your genetic code. Well, he says, don't for a second think I'm interested in anyone but you. He puts his hand on the back of my neck and draws my mouth toward his. The kiss and his words both comfort me, but my unease doesn't completely disappear.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Allegiant by Veronica Roth.
Chapter 25. Tobias. Triss and I meet Nita in the hotel lobby after midnight, among the potted plants with their unfurling flowers, a tame wilderness. When Nita sees Triss at my side, her face tightens like she just tasted something bitter. You promised you wouldn't tell her, she says, pointing at me. What happened to protecting her? I changed my mind, I say. Triss laughs harshly. That's what you told him? That he would be protecting me? That's a pretty skillful manipulation. Well done. I raise my eyebrows at her. I never thought of it as a manipulation, and that scares me a little. I can usually rely on myself to see a person's ulterior motives or to invent them in my mind, but I was so used to my desire to protect Triss, especially after almost losing her, that I didn't even think twice. Or I was so used to lying instead of telling difficult truths that I welcomed the chance to deceive her. It wasn't a manipulation, it was the truth. Nita doesn't look angry anymore, just tired, her hand sliding over her face and then smoothing back her hair. She isn't defensive, which means that she might be telling the truth. You could be arrested just for knowing what you know and not reporting it. I thought it would be better to avoid that. Well, too late, I say. Triss is coming. Is that a problem? I would rather have both of you than neither of you. And I'm sure that's the implied ultimatum, Nita says, rolling her eyes. Let's go. Triss, Nita, and I walk back through the silent, still compound to the laboratories where Nita works. None of us speaks, and I'm conscious of every squeak of my shoes, every voice in the distance, every snap of every closing door. I feel like we're doing something forbidden, though technically we aren't. Not yet, anyway. Nita stops by the door to the laboratories and scans her card. We follow her past the gene therapy room where I saw a map of my genetic code farther into the heart of the compound than I have been yet. It's dark and grim back here, and clumps of dust dance over the floor when we walk past. Nita pushes another door open with her shoulder, and we walk into a storage room. Dull metal drawers cover the walls, labeled with paper numbers, the ink worn off with time. In the center of the room is a lab table with a computer and a microscope, and a young man with slicked back blonde hair. Tobias, Triss, this is my friend Reggie, Nita says. He's also a GD. Nice to meet you, Reggie says with a smile. He shakes Triss's hand, then mine, his grip firm. Let's show them the slides first, Nita says. Reggie taps the computer screen and beckons us closer. Not gonna bite. Triss and I exchange a glance, then stand behind Reggie at the table to see the screen. Pictures start flashing on it, one after another. They are in grayscale and look grainy and distorted. They must be very old. It takes me only a few seconds to realize that they are photographs of suffering. Narrow, pinched children with huge eyes. Ditches full of bodies. Huge mounds of burning papers. The photographs move so fast, like book pages fluttering in the breeze, that I only get impressions of horrors. Then I turn my face away, unable to look any longer. I feel a deep silence grow inside me. At first, when I look at Triss, her expression is like still water, like the images we just saw caused no ripples. But then her mouth quivers, and she presses her lips together to disguise it.
Look at these weapons.
Reggie brings up a photograph with a man in uniform holding a gun and points.
That kind of gun is incredibly old. The guns used in the Purity War were much more advanced. Even the Bureau would agree with that. It's got to be from a really old conflict which must have been waged by genetically pure people, since genetic manipulation didn't exist back then.
How do you hide a war? I say.
People are isolated. Starving.
Nita says quietly.
They know only what they're taught. They see only the information that's made available to them. And who controls all that? The government.
Okay. Triss's head bobs and she's talking too fast, nervous. So they're lying about our history. That doesn't mean they're the enemy. It just means they're a group of grossly misinformed people trying to better the world in an ill-advised way.
Nita and Reggie glance at each other.
That's the thing, Nita says. They're hurting people. She puts her hand on the counter and leans into it, leans toward us, and again I see the revolutionary building strength inside her, taking over the parts of her that are young woman and GD and laboratory worker.
When the abnegation wanted to reveal the great truth of their world sooner than they were supposed to, she says slowly, and Janine wanted to stifle them, the Bureau was all too happy to provide her with an incredibly advanced simulation serum, the attack simulation that enslaved the minds of the Dauntless, that resulted in the destruction of abnegation.
I take a moment to let that sink in. That can't be true, I say. Janine told me that the highest proportion of divergent, the genetically pure, in any faction was in abnegation. You just said the Bureau values the genetically pure enough to send someone in to save them. Why would they help Janine kill them?
Janine was wrong, Triss says distantly. Evelyn said so. The highest proportion of divergent was among the factionless, not abnegation.
I turn to Nita. I still don't see why they would risk that many divergent, I say. I need evidence.
Why do you think we came here?
Nita switches on another set of lights that illuminate the drawers and paces along the left wall.
It took me a long time to get clearance to go in here, she says, even longer to acquire the knowledge to understand what I saw. I had help from one of the GPs, actually, a sympathizer.
Her hand hovers over one of the low drawers. From it, she takes a vial of orange liquid.
Look familiar?
She asks me. I try to remember the shot they gave me before the attack simulation began, right before the final round of Triss's initiation. Max did it, inserted the needle into the side of my neck as I had done myself dozens of times. Right before he did, the glass vial caught the light, and it was orange, just like whatever Nita is holding. The colors match, I say. So? Nita carries the vial to the microscope. Reggie takes a slide from a tray near the computer and, using a dropper, puts two drops of the orange liquid in its center, then seals the liquid in place with a second slide. As he places it on the microscope, his fingers are careful but certain. They are the movements of someone who has performed the same action hundreds of times. Reggie taps the computer screen a few times, opening a program called MicroScan.
This information is free and available to anyone who knows how to use this equipment and has the system password, which the GP sympathizer graciously gave me, Nita says. So in other words, it's not all that hard to access, but no one would think to examine it very closely. And GDs don't have system passwords, so it's not like we would have known about it. This storage room is for obsolete experiments, failures, or outdated developments, or useless things.
She looks through the microscope, using a knob on the side to focus the lens.
Go ahead,
she says. Reggie presses a button on the computer, and paragraphs of text appear under the microscan bar at the top of the screen. He points to a paragraph in the middle of the page, and I read it. Simulation Serum V4.2 coordinates a large number of targets, transmits signals over long distances. Hallucinogen from original formula not included. Simulated reality is predetermined by program master. That's it. That's the attack simulation serum. Now, why would the Bureau have this unless they had developed it? Nita says. They were the ones who put the serums into the experiments, but they usually left the serums alone, let the city residents develop them further. If Janine was the one who developed it, they wouldn't have stolen it from her. If it's here, it's because they made it. I stare at the illuminated slide in the microscope, at the orange droplets swimming in the eyepiece, and release a shaky breath. Triss says, breathless, "Why?" Abnegation was about to reveal the truth to everyone inside the city, and you've seen what's happened now that the city knows the truth. Evelyn is effectively a dictator. The factionless are squashing the faction members, and I'm sure the factions will rise up against them sooner or later. Many people will die. Telling the truth risks the safety of the experiment, no question, Nita says. So a few months ago, when the Abnegation were on the verge of causing that destruction and instability by revealing Edith Pryor's video to your city, the Bureau probably thought better that the Abnegation should suffer a great loss, even at the expense of several Divergent, than the whole city suffer a great loss. Better to end the lives of the Abnegation than to risk the experiment. So they reached out to someone who they knew would agree with them. Janine Matthews. Her words surround me and bury themselves inside me. I set my hands on the lab table, letting it cool my palms, and look at my distorted reflection in the brushed metal. I may have hated my father for most of my life, but I never hated his faction. Abnegation's quiet. Their community, their routine, always seemed good to me. And now most of those kind, giving people are dead. Murdered at the hands of the Dauntless, at the urging of Janine, with the power of the Bureau to back her. Triss's mother and father were among them. Triss stands so still, her hands dangling limply, turning red with the flush of her blood. This is the problem with their blind commitment to these experiments, Nita says next to us, as if sliding the words into the empty spaces of our minds. The Bureau values the experiments above GD lives. It's obvious. And now things could get even worse. Worse? I say. Worse than killing most of the Abnegation? How? The government has been threatening to shut down the experiments for almost a year now, Nita says. The experiments keep falling apart because the communities can't live in peace, and David keeps finding ways to restore peace just in the nick of time. And if anything else goes wrong in Chicago, he can do it again. He can reset all the experiments at any time. Reset them, I say. With the Abnegation memory serum, Reggie says. Well, really, it's the Bureau's memory serum. Every man, woman, and child will have to begin again. Nita says tersely, their entire lives erased against their will for the sake of solving a genetic damage problem that doesn't actually exist. These people have the power to do that, and no one should have that power. I remember the thought I had after Johanna told me about the Amity administering the memory serum to Dauntless patrols, that when you take a person's memories, you change who they are. Suddenly, I don't care what Nita's plan is, as long as it means striking the Bureau as hard as we can. What I have learned in the past few days has made me feel like there is nothing about this place worth salvaging. What's the plan? Says Triss, her voice flat, almost mechanical. I'll let my friends from the Fringe in through the underground tunnel, Nita says. Tobias, you will shut off the security system as I do, so that we aren't caught. It's nearly the same technology you worked with in the Dauntless control room. It should be easy for you. Then Raffi, Mary and I will break into the weapons lab and steal the memory serum so the Bureau can't use it. Reggie's been helping behind the scenes, but he'll be opening the tunnel for us on the day of the attack. What will you do with a bunch of memory serum? I say. Destroy it. Nita says, even-keeled. I feel strange. Empty like a deflated balloon. I don't know what I had in mind when Nita talked about her plan, but it wasn't this. This feels so small, so passive as an act of retaliation against the people responsible for the attack simulation. The people who told me that there was something wrong with me at my very core, in my genetic code. That's all you intend to do? Triss says, finally looking away from the microscope.
She narrows her eyes at Nita. You know that the Bureau is responsible for the murders of hundreds of people, and your plan is to take away their memory serum? I don't remember inviting your critique of my plan. I'm not critiquing your plan, Triss says. I'm telling you I don't believe you. You hate these people. I can tell by the way you talk about them. Whatever you intend to do, I think it's far worse than stealing some serum. The memory serum is what they use to keep the experiments running. It's their greatest source of power over your city, and I want to take it away. I'd say that's a hard enough blow for now. Nita sounds gentle, like she's explaining something to a child. I never said this was all I was ever going to do. It's not always wise to strike as hard as you can at the first opportunity. This is a long race, not a sprint. Triss just shakes her head. Tobias, are you in? Nita says. I look from Triss with her tense, stiff posture to Nita, who is relaxed, ready. I don't see whatever Triss sees or hear it. And when I think about saying no, I feel like my body will collapse in on itself. I have to do something. Even if it's small, I have to do something, and I don't understand why Triss doesn't feel the same desperation inside her. Yes, I say. Triss turns to me, her eyes wide, incredulous. I ignore her. I can disable the security system. I'll need some Amity Peace Serum. Do you have access to that? I do. Nita smiles a little. I'll send you a message with the timing. Come on, Reggie. Let's leave these two to talk. Reggie nods to me and then to Triss, and then he and Nita both leave the room, easing the door closed behind them so it doesn't make a sound. Triss turns to me, her arms folded like two bars across her body, keeping me out. I can't believe you, she said. She's lying. Why can't you see that? Because it's not there, I say. I can tell when someone's lying just as well as you can, and in this situation, I think your judgment might be clouded by something else. Something like jealousy. I am not jealous, she says, scowling at me. I am being smart. She has something bigger planned, and if I were you, I would run far away from anyone who lies to me about what they want me to participate in. Well, you're not me. I shake my head. God, Triss, these people murdered your parents and you're not going to do something about it? I never said I wasn't going to do anything, she says tersely. But I don't have to buy into the first plan I hear either. You know, I brought you here because I wanted to be honest with you, not so that you could make snap judgments about people and tell me what to do. Remember what happened last time you didn't trust my snap judgments? Triss says coldly. You found out that I was right. I was right about Edith Pryor's video changing everything, and I was right about Evelyn, and I'm right about this. Yeah, you're always right, I say. Were you right about running into dangerous situations without weapons? Were you right about lying to me and going on a death march to Erudite headquarters in the middle of the night? Or about Peter? Were you right about him? Don't throw those things in my face. She points at me, and I feel like I'm a child getting lectured by a parent. I never said I was perfect, but you can't even see past your own desperation. You went along with Evelyn because you were desperate for a parent, and now you're going along with this because you're desperate not to be damaged. The word shivers through me. I am not damaged, I say quietly. I can't believe you have so little faith in me that you would tell me not to trust myself. I shake my head. And I don't need your permission. I start toward the door, and as my hand closes around the handle, she says, Just leaving so that you can have the last word, that's really mature. So is being suspicious of someone's motives just because she's pretty, I say. I guess we're even. I leave the room. I am not a desperate, unsteady child who throws his trust around. I am not damaged.
Chapter 26. Triss. I touch my forehead to the eyepiece of the microscope. The serum swims before me, orange-brown. I was so busy looking for Nita's lies that I barely registered the truth. In order to get their hands on this serum, the Bureau must have developed it and somehow delivered it to Janine to use. I pull away. Why would Janine work with the Bureau when she so badly wanted to stay in the city, away from them? But I guess the Bureau and Janine shared a common goal. Both wanted the experiment to continue. Both were terrified of what would happen if it didn't. Both were willing to sacrifice innocent lives to do it. I thought this place could be home. But the Bureau is full of killers. I rock back on my heels as if pushed back by some invisible force, then walk out of the room, my heart beating fast. I ignore the few people dawdling in the corridor in front of me. I just push farther into the Bureau compound, farther and farther into the belly of the beast. Maybe this place could be home, I hear myself saying to Christina. These people murdered your parents. Tobias's words echo in my head. I don't know where I'm going except that I need space and air. I clutch my ID in my hand and half walk, half run past the security barrier to the sculpture. There is no light shining into the tank now, though the water still falls from it. One drop for every second that passes. I stand for a little while, watching it. And then, across the slab of stone, I see my brother. Are you all right? He says tentatively. I am not all right. I was beginning to feel that I had finally found a place to stay, a place that was not so unstable or corrupt or controlling that I could actually belong there. You would think that I would have learned by now. Such a place does not exist. No, I say. He starts to move around the stone block, toward me. What is it? What is it? I laugh. Let me put it this way. I just found out you're not the worst person I know. I drop into a crouch and push my fingers through my hair. I feel numb and terrified of my own numbness. The Bureau is responsible for my parents' deaths. Why do I have to keep repeating it to myself to believe it? What's wrong with me? Oh, he says. I'm sorry. All I can manage is a small grunt. You know what Mom told me once? He says, and the way he says Mom, like he didn't betray her, sets my teeth on edge. She said that everyone has some evil inside them, and the first step to loving anyone is to recognize the same evil in ourselves, so we're able to forgive them. Is that what you want me to do? I say dully as I stand. I may have done bad things, Caleb, but I would never deliver you to your own execution. You can't say that, he says, and it sounds like he's pleading with me, begging me to say that I am just like him, no better. You didn't know how persuasive Janine was. Something inside me snaps, like a brittle rubber band. I punch him in the face. All I can think about is how the erudite stripped me of my watch and my shoes and led me to the bare table where they would take my life. A table that Caleb may as well have set up himself. I thought I was beyond this kind of anger, but as he stumbles back with his hands on his face, I pursue him, grabbing the front of his shirt and slamming him against the stone sculpture and screaming that he is a coward and a traitor and that I will kill him. I will kill him. One of the guards comes toward me, and all she has to do is put her hand on my arm, and the spell is broken. I release Caleb's shirt. I shake out my stinging hand. I turn and walk away. There's a beige sweater draped over the empty chair in Matthew's lab, the sleeve brushing the floor. I've never met his supervisor. I'm beginning to suspect that Matthew does all the real work. I sit on top of the sweater and examine my knuckles. A few of them are split from punching Caleb and dotted with faint bruises. It seems fitting that the blow would leave a mark on both of us. That's how the world works. Last night, when I went back to the dormitory, Tobias wasn't there, and I was too angry to sleep. In the hours that I lay awake, staring at the ceiling, I decided that while I wasn't going to participate in Nita's plan, I also wasn't going to stop it. The truth about the attack simulation brewed hate for the Bureau inside me, and I want to watch it break apart from within. Matthew is talking science. I'm having trouble paying attention. Doing some genetic analysis, which is fine, but before we were developing a way to make the memory compound behave as a virus, he says, with the same rapid replication, the same ability to spread through the air. And then we developed a vaccination for it. Just a temporary one. Only lasts for 48 hours, but still. I nod. So, you were making it so you could set up other city experiments more efficiently, right? I say. No need to inject everyone with a memory serum, when you can just release it and let it spread. Exactly. He seems excited that I'm actually interested in what he's saying. And it's a better model for having the option to select particular members of a population to opt out. You inoculate them. The virus spreads within 24 hours, and it has no effect on them. I nod again. You okay? Matthew says, his coffee mug poised near his mouth. He puts it down. I heard the security guards had to pull you off someone last night. It was my brother, Caleb. Ah. Matthew raises an eyebrow. What did he do this time? Nothing, really. I pinch the sweater sleeve between my fingers. Its edges are all fraying, wearing with time. I was wired to explode anyway. He just got in the way. I already know, by looking at him, the question he's asking, and I want to explain it all to him, everything that Nita showed me and told me. I wonder if I can trust him. I heard something yesterday, I say, testing the waters. About the Bureau. About my city and the simulations. He straightens up and gives me a strange look. What? I say. Did you hear that something from Nita? He says. Yes. How did you know that? I've helped her a couple times, he says. I let her into that storage room. Did she tell you anything else? Matthew is Nita's informant? I stare at him. I never thought that Matthew, who went out of his way to show me the difference between my pure genes and Tobias's damaged genes, might be helping Nita. Something about a plan? I say slowly. He gets up and walks toward me, oddly tense. I lean away from him by instinct. Is it happening? He says. Do you know when? What's going on? I say. Why would you help Nita? Because all this genetic damage nonsense is ridiculous, he says. It's very important that you answer my questions. It is happening, and I don't know when. But I think it will be soon. Shit. Matthew puts his hands on his face. Nothing good can come of this. If you don't stop saying cryptic things, I'm going to slap you, I say, getting to my feet. I was helping Nita until she told me what she and those fringe people wanted to do, Matthew says. They want to get to the weapons lab and steal the memory serum. Yeah, I heard. No, he shakes his head. No. They don't want the memory serum. They want the death serum. Similar to the one the erudite have. The one you were supposed to be injected with when you were almost executed. They're going to use it for assassinations. A lot of them. Set off an aerosol can, and it's easy, see? Give it to the right people, and you have an explosion of anarchy and violence, which is exactly what those fringe people want. I do see. I see the tilt of a vial. The quick press of a button on an aerosol can. I see abnegation bodies and erudite bodies sprawled over streets and staircases. I see the little pieces of this world that we've managed to cling to, bursting into